Welcome to the Jeff Knows Inc. Entrepreneurial Podcast with your host, Jeff Lopes. Jeff has over two decades experience as a serial entrepreneur, building brands like Kimuraware from his home basement to a multi-million dollar global brand that has sold over a quarter million pairs of boxing gloves. Jeff's here to educate, guide, and drive you on the process of bringing your ideas and dreams to reality with the inspiring stories from some of the top business minds.
Welcome to episode number 59 of the Jeff Knows Inc. podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Lopes. Super excited to have on today, Shamal. What a wonderful individual. Great life lessons today. Great inspirational story. Everyone just sit back and enjoy this episode. This has been one of my favorite recordings so far. We are live on the Jeff Knows Inc. podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Lopes. We got a special guest from South Africa. Am I correct? Not today. But originally, you're living in South Africa. Shalmi.
That is correct.
How are you, brother?
I'm doing very, very well. Thanks, Jeff. I'm loving being on the show. Thank you for inviting me.
I'm super stoked, man, to have you guys. There's so many layers of your background and so many things you've accomplished. So it's going to be a great conversation. I always start off by allowing our audience to get to know currently what you're doing, and then we'll see the conversation from there. So currently in your life right now, are you currently coming out with a new book?
Yes, I just recently launched my new book. It's called Breed, Believe, Balance. It launched on the 3rd of August in India, in the subcontinent. And right now, I have a content creation company called QSV Inspiration Media. I make documentaries. But my background is in sports science and psychology. And then I spent a little bit of time in the ashram as a monk. So I blend spirituality with everything. So no matter what I'm doing, you'll find that these three lenses are very prominent in every single thing that I do.
Let's dive into the first one. The whole thing with the 3 years, I do want to dive into that. It's a very interesting aspect of what you did with the monks. But let's dive into your sports science and sports training with athletes and stuff like that. When did it all start? And you've worked with a lot of big athletes. So when did that all start and how did that all process?
So, Jeff, I always wanted to be a professional athlete growing up, you know, yeah. And I used to play cricket in South Africa. But I grew up playing cricket in the late 80s, early 90s. And that was a time when we had the apartheid, which was institutionalized segregation of people of color. So I'm of Indian origin and I was considered a person of color. And what happened was that opportunities for people of color were very, very restricted. So even though I played and even though I was really good, the opportunities were really minuscule. And I didn't realize how restricted it was till I turned 18 and I had to play open competitive sport. And I realized that, the bars or the standards for people of color and everyone else was so grossly different that, and even irrespective of how hard you worked, you know, you were never really guaranteed of an opportunity. But the truth was that, you know, I wasn't ready to turn my back on sport, which was why I started studying sports science. And I went into university, I studied for 4 years. Sports science is really the study of human performance, the impact of exercise on your human physiology. And I specialize in muscle physiology and biomechanics from a sports science lens. And that was really a fascinating turn for me because, you know, I instantaneously, one day I was a player and the very next day I was a coach because when I decided to start studying there, the cricket team paid for all my studies and they didn't want me to leave the sport. So they immediately gave me a position of being a strength and conditioning / performance coach with the team. So it was quite a mind shift because one day I'm the person listening to instructions and the very, very next day I'm the person giving instructions to people who were my mentors in many shapes and form. So at 19 years old, I really deep dived into the coaching lens and then everything's really evolved from there.
19, now you're quite young.
I am now 40.
No, but I'm saying when you did start coaching with the aspect 19, it was quite young. So how long did you stay on? How long did you stay on with that current team you were with originally coaching?
I stayed on with them for till the end of my graduation, which was about 22. When I graduated, I tried to get an increase in a salary. They didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I left. I also coincidentally, I think this nothing's a coincidence, but the team that I was with was probably one of the best domestic cricket teams in South Africa. So we went year by year, just winning competitions. And then after I graduated, I really wanted to also test my own mettle. So I moved to a team that were bottom of the log, you know, and had been consistently bottom of the log for a long time. So I went in there, worked with a coach. And in the first year, we lost in the final in one competition. In the second year, we lost in the final in the 4-day competition in there. And then I moved back to my original team. But in between this entire time, I got an amazing stint to be the technical analyst of the Indian cricket team at the World Cup in 2003. You know, and I think really what my main approach to was with sports science was I was really willing to test various approaches, and I think that was the secret. You know, and you know, one of the beauty things about sport was that I was in a very luxurious position because I had a university backing me, I had an academic qualification, I had a research lab, and I also had access to professional athletes. So most active researchers don't have access to professional athletes. And this is really something interesting, you'll know, Jeff, is that most of the research that people use is done on suboptimal athletes. You know, it's done suboptimally, which means that you're not using professional athletes, you're using professional amateurs. Okay. Yeah. Because you can't keep poking and prodding and testing professional athletes because you got to pull them out of their training regime, which is uncalled for. Right. So I had that advantage of constantly working with professional athletes. So I was being able to gather research and data from athletes who were really at the forefront. And that provided a lot of advantage to me in the academic world.
That is amazing. So that let's fast forward now. So 19, 22, you left your team. You started working with another team. How long did you work with that lower end team? And how, and what, like, did you see results from them? How long were you till you started seeing?
We saw some amazing results. One was they were bottom of the log. So we reached two different finals. We reached a 50 over final. We reached a 4-day final, one in each consecutive year. The coach of that team then migrated to become the coach of the national team based on that performance. I got called on to be the technical analyst with the Indian cricket team. Yeah. And for the first time, we had almost 3 or 4 players make the South African A team that year. So from being a little dot on the map, there was suddenly a force to reckon with in the cricketing circles in South Africa.
That's amazing. That's amazing. So fast forward, you've worked with a lot of, I was just looking at a lot of Olympic athletes, tennis athletes and stuff like that. How did you guide and start navigating into the tennis world and other avenues?
Yeah, that's interesting. So after the cricket, after the World Cup, I went back to Durban for a while. And I noticed that, you know, the apartheid system, even though we were in a free and fair South Africa, had not really changed. Yeah. The opportunities for people of color, especially in the coaching circuit now, were very restricted. You know, we had a quota system for players, but we had no quota system for coaching and support staff. So I found the opportunities becoming very restricted. And to be honest, I was struggling to deal with the pain and the bitterness of that situation. So I moved into the ashram for a while. I started living in the ashram one day. And that one day turned into almost 3.5 years. And I did some intermittent work in between.
How old are you when that happened?
That's probably about 23 years old.
So you're still quite young. That's a big, yeah, big dedication for that age.
Yeah, it was, you know, the problem was, it was not like I had options, you know. To pursue a career in sport, I was fighting with my family, and my family didn't really want me to go this route because they knew how difficult this road was. They wanted me to study medicine, or I come from a jewelry family. So I fought with everyone. And now when the situation hadn't changed, I was back up against the wall. I couldn't go back to them because I'd already been fighting with them for years to get to where I am. So I didn't know where to turn. And the only place I knew was that, okay, you know what? I need some peace of mind. I was familiar with the temple. I'd spent some time there. So I just went there. I didn't plan to move in. I just drove. One day I drove to work at 5 o'clock in the morning and 6 o'clock in the afternoon after having an exhausting day that of the same thing. I just drove to the temple and stayed there. And then one day went into the next and the next. And before I'd known it, months had gone by, years had gone by, and I'd been there. And then over a period of 6 months, I started to taper my workout from professional sport. I did a few select assignments with the cricket team. And incidentally, how I got into tennis was the person who interviewed me for the South African cricket job was the financial manager of the cricket team. And 6 months after that, he'd left that position and he took over the CEO of South African tennis. And he phones me up one day and he says, you know, I really admire the work you do. I really loved your interview. Would you like to be the head high performance coach for the South African Davis Cup team? And we're just 3 weeks in the year. So I jumped at the opportunity. It gave me an opportunity to travel. So that's how I really dipped my feet into the world of tennis. I spent 2 years with the South African Davis Cup team. And in 2007, I got a call from India saying that, you know, we want to prepare the Indian contingent for the Beijing Olympics. Will you be interested in taking over this position you've come recommended? So I jumped at it and I moved to India, also because my spiritual master at the time was based in India. So it gave me an opportunity to connect more with him. And I'd now started peeling away the layers of understanding the gap between spirituality and modern psychology. And I wanted to close that gap. So I saw India being a really important integral step in bridging that gap. So I jumped at that opportunity. And then I stayed with the Indian team from Beijing Olympics through to London Olympics. And I traveled with them consistently on the ATP tour for 6 years. And in 2012, after the Olympics, I moved and settled in India to start a business.
And how long? So at that point, you were in living in India for 4 years with traveling with the Olympic team. How long did you live in India after that? Are you currently living there? You still are there. So you're not in South Africa.
I'm South African. I still travel on a South African passport, but Mumbai is my home.
Oh, beautiful.
And, my work takes me around the world. I still work with professional athletes and sports teams around the world. I spend some time in Kenya with the marathon runners. I travel with cricket teams in various parts of the world. I have athletes on the professional tennis tour. So I'm still traveling quite consistently, but Mumbai is my base right now because I have a few businesses that have been set up here.
Can we dive into those? What businesses you have set up there?
Yeah. So the first business I set up in 2012 was called the Heal Institute. It was India's first physical therapy and physiotherapy practice. And we built a chain of businesses. So the entire premise of building that business was born from the discrimination Indian athletes were facing. See, I'd come from a deep background of discrimination. Right. And when I moved to India, I thought my days of discrimination were over. But in working with the athletes, I noticed that the government and the athletes were getting really no support. They were given no coaches, no trainers. They were given no money. There were no food, no supplements, no team doctor. Even the apparel they were wearing was suboptimal. And these people are representing a country of 1.4 billion people. Yeah. I go to the Olympics. The first year I went, we had a team of about 89 athletes. So we were allowed about 30 or 35 support staff to accompany these. At least 20 of those went to the administrators in the Olympic Association. So we're grossly understaffed in terms of coaches and trainers to help them prepare whilst these athletes were competing. I mean, we had boxers who didn't even have physiotherapists. We had track and field athletes who were not given proper shoes and stuff. So I thought this was a different form of discrimination. So I stayed on another 4 years to help eradicate this. I tried to work with the government, but very little happened. At the end of 2012, I realized that this is not going to change. And if these athletes are going to stand any chance of competing on an international platform, then something needs to be changed. And because my expertise was in medicine, I set up a business that was really aimed at teaching doctors, physiotherapists, trainers, how to work with professional athletes at that level. So it was really a business set up to empower the practitioner. It was a B2B business, but we had a B2C component just because we needed money. And after 6 months in that business, we made a really important pivot because I realized that sports science was very nascent and we were seen as a threat. Right? So coaches who didn't understand sports science didn't embrace it. They felt threatened by it. you know, sports scientists, physios, everybody felt threatened by the fact, by us giving data that they weren't aware of. But at the same time, something was unfolding. In the orthopedic industry in India, we noticed that a lot of people were coming to me for surgeries. And I could not understand why they were even getting operated in the first place, even though we were managing the rehab. And then I realized that the orthopedic industry in India was running a very unscrupulous practice. You know, people who, by Western standards, should never have been operated. People who should have been treated conservatively with rehabilitation for a period of 3 to 6 months, then being given a corticosteroid injection to manage pain and treatment again before surgery, was not being followed. You know, people were being operated every single day. I'll give you one example. Working with the South African cricket teams, my friend was the head doctor with them, and he was a knee surgeon. He was averaging about 450 to 500 knee surgeries a year. Wow. And he was the best knee surgeon in South Africa. In India, people were doing three times that amount in a month. Okay, so that is the quantum of surgeries every single doctor was doing. So what our business started becoming, and what I really started becoming, was an advocate for non-surgical rehabilitation in the country. I started taking on the medical system, the pharma systems, started being the voice for non-surgical practitioners, making sure physiotherapy. When I started my business, the physiotherapy rate, Jeff, was 50 rupees. That's under a dollar for an hour session. Physiotherapy session. That's what physios were getting paid, right? And it was ludicrous. I mean, it's impossible to live. And they were kept so below the, you know, the line to live a comfortable life, yeah, that they really had no disposable time to even think of studying or raise their voice or doing something. If a handful of them who decide to go and study abroad would spend $20,000 to get a master's degree, and they would literally spend their entire life paying for that. You know, I slowly started. The first thing I tried to do was really raise the quality and then raise the price, you know. So we moved that up. So now a physiotherapy session in India would be anywhere from $50 to $100, which is a lot more respectable. So, you know, we're finding that these guys have now got disposable income. They're happier. They can work. They can give more time to their patient. They can educate themselves. And that was really the first business that took off. And it grew to about 10 centers across Mumbai. We're treating about 150,000 patients before the digital world really exploded as such. And I exited it in 2018. Then I started a content company because I thought that, okay, you know, digital media will give me a better idea or a better presence to get my message to a wider audience and help them. So that's where I am.
So let's dive into, I mean, that's a great story. A lot of, which I love and I find inspiring, is a lot of your work, there is a message and there's intent behind it for the better purpose. And everything you're doing, you're doing stuff that a lot of people wouldn't do, which is take on government policy, take on opportunity to help people. So I love everything you're doing. So congratulations on that, brother. It's amazing to find individuals that dedicate so much time, because life's busy. Life gets crazy. There's a lot of opportunity to focus on yourself. So when you could actually focus on helping the overall people and setting a footprint in this world that's going to better the future, it's amazing. So congratulations on that, brother. So moving forward, your digital company, let's dive into that. What are we currently doing? Are we currently working on the digital company still?
Yeah.
So let's give us a rundown of what it does and where you're reaching out to and how you're impacting people with that.
So it really started with a show that I created called In Pursuit of Balance, where I wanted to speak with thought leaders, industry leaders, experts in certain fields, who could give their message of how to find balance in their life. You know, it was that show that really gave birth to the book that I wrote, because I had guests like His Holiness Radhanath Swami, who was a New York Times bestselling author, Kailas Satyarthi. Then I was getting Sachin Tendulkar. Then I was getting a few international speakers. So I was getting some big names on there, and each one of them was breaking down their journey of balance. And, you know, when I peeled away the layers of their journey, I found that every single individual in life goes through three battles. The first battle starts when you're a teenager up till about 30 years old, which is a battle that is external, which is the establishing of your credibility. You're trying to establish how will the world recognize you and how will you be known and how will you stand out. So your identity. The second battle is internal. It's a battle of shattering all your limiting beliefs. OK, Okay. And when you shatter all your limiting beliefs, it's like everything that you thought coming from your family, every dream that you had, as you start working, you realize that perhaps the bar was too low and you start breaking that glass ceiling, you know, from the amount of money you had in the bank to where you live, to the type of home and the car you drive and whatever it is. But every single one of these people reaches a point in time when they face the third battle. And that's called the battle of transcendence. When you realize that no amount of money, no amount of identity, no amount of possessions will make you happy. You will be remembered for what you give back to the world. Right? So at a late stage in their life, they try to use everything that they have to make the world a better place. And no matter who I spoke to, I found the exact same patterns existed. So that's what made me peel away the layers of this book called Breed, Believe, Balance that helps someone address these three problems in life. Right? How do you find your identity? How do you shatter these beliefs? But how do you use the best of who you are to make the world around you a better place? Okay. And it started with that. And slowly I started peeling away layers of this. I realized that my content really expanded. You know, I put out content, I grew from 15,000 Instagram followers to 150,000 in the space of 45 days. And took a break from, because I realized that, you know, it just exploded because people were ready to listen to this and there was nobody giving it to them. You know, nobody was breaking down things to them. You know, we come from an industry of Bollywood. So you got celebrities selling every single thing on earth, you know, whether it's cement to cosmetics to MCT oil, everything's got a celebrity's face on it, but nobody's peeling away the layers of why this is good for you. And I started doing that. I started giving people the science, the evidence-based science, the psychology, the methodology of how to improve yourself. And it just exploded, you know, everyone. And that's when I realized that the time is right and the country is right and that people are no more interested in heroes. They're interested in making themselves the hero, you know, and all they need is a method. And that's what the content company is there. So all I'm doing is talking to inspirational people. I'm doing tons of research, peeling away the layers, and I give it away to most people. 99% of it is given away for free, right? Unless you're buying a ticket to a show of mine or something. But everything's given away for free. And you just peel away the layers and you discover yourself. And one of my friends, see, I come from a very spiritual upbringing and I lived in the temple. So one of my core values is service. You know, always serving others. Even when I sign off my email, I say with love, gratitude, and in your service. Okay. So, and one of my friends who's a very big investor in companies taught me something. He's like, he says, you know, he invests in companies in tech and medicine, but he has one rule only. His one rule is that I will invest in the entrepreneur, provided the entrepreneur is prepared to give 50% of his exiting wealth back to community. In any shape and form that he wants to. We won't tell him how to give it. We won't tell him who to give it to. We won't tell him what charity, what cause, but he needs to pledge to give 50% back, right? So we're trying to create an ecosystem of, we understand that the thread that's holding each of us together is the thread of transcendence. We all want to use what we have to make the community around us bigger and better. And just the layers in which we're doing it and the levers through which we're doing it in the form of companies are slightly different. But that's what we're trying to build right now.
That is amazing. That is amazing. I love that. So with this company, where do you see it going in the next 3-4 years? So you said you do a lot of guests. Are you currently doing guest speaking? Obviously with the pandemic, that might've changed, but you were doing a lot of, let's get to the TEDx. When did that happen? That's a big platform for you to voice your, to hear your voice, right? When did you do the TEDx speaking?
So I've done a few TEDx events, and last year I hosted TEDx Gateway.
Oh, wow.
TEDx Gateway is the biggest TEDx property in the world. It's actually numbers wise, it's bigger than TED Talks in one. Yeah. And I was a host of that. And that was a phenomenal experience. So I keep going back now to help them and host these events. Speaking, I've spoken at a few events in South Africa, in Cape Town, quite a few in India. The licenses, I think there's probably more TEDx licenses in India than anywhere else in the world because I keep getting invites to these. I think it's a fantastic platform. I think almost every single school in the country has their own TEDx license, and they're trying to create their own shape and form. And Do you know, I have a rule, Jeff. If someone under the age of 25 writes to me for a speaking opportunity, I don't say no. You know, because, you know, I think that everyone needs someone to believe in them. And you never know who the guest is that's going to just let the penny drop, that's going to give them enough inspiration and motivation to move forward. So if an organization or a nonprofit or school writes to me, or some entrepreneur is doing something and he's under the age of 25 and he needs me, I 99.9% of the time, I will never say no. I'll try to fit it in some shape and form.
That is amazing. And we had talked prior to going live. That's one thing that, like I said, in the last three plus years, I've been putting a lot of young entrepreneurs under my wing, and the same thing, I don't charge. And it's just more of giving back to community, giving back what the experiences I've gone through for 24 years, and hopefully my experiences will guide them in the right path. Right. And it's just giving back your wealth, and it's just giving back your, to me, wealth is knowledge and time, right? Freedom. So I'm trying to pass that all on to young entrepreneurs and help guide them in the right direction. So I love that aspect, because it's all about, I mean, we're on this earth for such a short time, right? And I love the bear pack that you said. A lot of entrepreneurs, when they get to a certain age, they feel like now is the opportunity to give back. In reality, you should be giving back from day one in one shape or form. And everybody has different impacts, right? You don't have to impact the life of thousands. If you're impacting the life of one person at a time, you're doing great work, right? So it's just finding the level of where you want to be and where you are and impacting on your level. And then it just spirals. It just grows. It's like that domino effect. The more people you help, they help others. And just you're building this inner community of helping, which is, I love everything you're doing, man. Everything you say, just what I love about what you're doing is everything that you're talking about, your past, your current, your future, you have a glimpse of a smile on your face. So you're enjoying it. You're in the moment. Yeah. You're enjoying it, which is so special, right? It's very easy as an entrepreneur to be caught up in that world of just go, 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 go. And you don't live in the present. You're always thinking about the next job, the next venture, the next thing. And it's so important for entrepreneurs to understand is two things. One, I always tell everybody, people always ask me when it comes to helping or starting something, they're like, when can we start? When should first, today is the moment. Don't wait for tomorrow. And second is impact as many people as you can. One way or another, find a way of impacting, whether it's through your business, whether it's through social, impact people, because it's just you're just helping spread the love and spread the community and just build. So I love everything you're doing, brother. Congrats on all that.
It's amazing. You know, in the book, I was talking about the process to self-transcendence, and I was telling someone, you know, Vedic sciences teaches you that if you truly want to give, you've got to disassociate from the physical act of giving, even mentally. And I give them the example. I said, you know, I want you to imagine you're walking down the road and you come across a beggar and you give him $1,000. And then you're walking down the road again and you come across another beggar and you give him $10. Which one of those acts do you think you're going to hold in your memory for longer? You know, and you're going to hold the act of giving $1,000, even if you don't want to, it's given. But the fact is, if the quantum is bigger, you're going to emotionally hold on to it for longer. So I said the secret to really transcending and giving and creating an impact is actually micro giving, is to give 10,000 people, right? Give micro so that it's done and it's out of your memory. You see, all of us have this threshold beyond which you'll forget something. You know, below which you'll forget something. For some of us, it may be $10. For some, it may be $100. For some, it may be $10,000. If you stay below that, your memory won't hold on to it. It'll be gone because it's the frequency of it's happening so often. And that's really the secret of not holding on to anything. And you know, when I coach entrepreneurs, I often tell them, I said, any entrepreneur who tells me I want to make a company and I want that company to make $50 million and I want to give it all back to charity. And I said, you know, there are far easier ways to satisfy your ego. Okay, then doing that, trust me, because the only thing you're achieving is you're satisfying your ego by that quantum of giving away. You can make 100,000 times more impact by micro giving from day one, right? And, you know, it's just no one will care about it. But the thing is, if the intention is to truly give, you wouldn't even care about it as well.
Exactly.
You know? So I keep saying, what is intention? We don't use this word often enough. You know, intention is something that's not vocalized. Intention doesn't even have to be in action. Intention is what you hold between your two ears, right? What is that thought that you're ruminating on that's driving that change or behavior, right? That needs a lot more awareness, because actually that is the secret to everything. If that thought is right, if that intention is right, then it's going to have a beautiful snowball effect in the right direction. If that is wrong, it's going to have a snowball effect in the other direction, you know? So my advice to entrepreneurs is always, you know, why are you doing this? And when you're answering that question, you need courage and you need honesty, you know, and you need vulnerability and you need transparency. And if you cannot answer that question with vulnerability, courage, bravery, and honesty, then the impact you wish to create is only in your mind. It will not materialize because you don't even understand the blueprint for what is needed to make it materialize, you know?
Yeah, that's beautiful. I'm gonna take a couple steps back because this is something I'm interested in. I just want to hear, when you're back those 3 years studying with the monks, give me a day-to-day to you. Was it a lot of physical? Was it spiritual study? Was it mental? Like, what was a day-to-day experience for you?
Yeah, it was quite difficult. I tell you, when you live in the ashram, you got to wake up at 3:30 a.m. every single day. You get into the temple hall from 4 a.m. till about 7:30, you're meditating in the morning. Okay. Now to get to wake up at 3:30, you got to literally be in bed by 7:30 or 8:39 latest night. Yeah. If you don't sleep by 9, you're going to struggle to wake up at 3:30. Okay. At 7:30, you wake up then, after your meditation's done, you go for a specific class. It's called a Bhagavatam class from about 7:30 to about 8:30, quarter to 9. 9 o'clock, you have breakfast. After breakfast, you go and do your chores around the temple, whatever work you have, you tidy your room. Some people will go out and they'll preach. Some will start studying. You have your second meal at lunchtime, which is 2 o'clock. And in the temple, there are only two meals. So you only eat 9 o'clock breakfast and 2 o'clock lunch, and then you're fasting thereafter. Okay. And then in the afternoon, you go about your chores as well. So I would generally go to universities and preach, or if I had any work, I would go out and do that work and then come back. Sometimes I was working with sports teams, so I'd attend a few training sessions in the afternoon. I'd skip lunch or something like that. And, you know, the temple taught me a few important things. You know, one of the most difficult lessons I learned was that I struggled to wake up at 3:30 in the morning because I could not commit to getting to bed at 9. And, you know, before analyzing sleep and before analyzing anything else, I realized that the biggest mistake people make is they set an alarm for waking up. You actually need to control what time you go to bed. Because if you control what time you go to bed, your body's natural biological clock will control. Can't control what time you go into bed, you're going, your operating system is counterintuitive to your biological clock. That's the first thing. The second thing I realized is that after 4 months of waking up every single day at 3:30 a.m., Jeff, I was in no position to meditate because I was sleeping so late that I was exhausted in the hot summer heat. I used to have a hoodie over my head. Sometimes I was falling asleep. I couldn't focus at all. And then one day the penny dropped and it says that, you know what, if I plan to be here, if I plan to wake up every day at 3:30, then I have to get to bed at 9. And it was just a realization. No one told me anything. No one came and said, but it was like 4 months of just constant fatigue in the morning, realizing that I have to be here. Then the mind just has this jolt of energy where it realizes that, shit, I got to do this every single day or I got to get out of here. If I plan to stay, I got to do it. And if I have to do this, I might as well sleep early to make the best of this. And ever since I made that decision, meditation, the whole process started getting easier. And the reason why I tell the story is because I've read so many books where people say it takes 30 days to form a habit. It takes 60 days to form a habit. It takes 100 days to form a habit. In my opinion, that's all rubbish, right? You know, the only way you can form a habit is when you don't have a time frame attached to it. You see, discipline is when you stick to something long enough for it to break you before it makes you. And as long as you have a time frame attached to it, your brain can wire and you can motivate yourself to that time frame. But if there's no time frame, that's when it really becomes a habit. When you don't say to yourself, I'm doing this for 30 days, I'm doing this for 100 days. When you say to yourself, I have to do this for the rest of my life, with no end goal, then all your physical and cognitive faculties will align to helping you achieve that. Right? When there's no way out, right? You'll find a way to make it happen. But as long as there's a way out, and the time frame is the metaphorical way out, you say to yourself, I got to do this for 100 days, and 100 days is your way out, because you hit 100 days and that's the door opens, right? That's not a habit. You see, the brain is very good at motivating ourselves, you know, and we've seen a direct relationship between someone's IQ and your ability to motivate yourself. So if you're really, really smart, you can actually push yourself beyond that. But once you hit that time frame, you're done. You won't sustain that thing. So discipline, for me, I've learned this, and I've used this in the world of sport as well. I've said that discipline is sticking to something for long enough for it to break you before it actually makes you. It has to break you before it makes you. Okay. And then there's another interesting thing that I learned in the ashram, but this one was when I was in India and I was traveling. And this is a beautiful lesson around habits as well. You know, I was traveling to this massive festival called the Kumbh Mela, which is the largest gathering of yogis in the world. It happens once every 12 years. Jeff, over 45 days, 130 million people will descend at this one place. Wow. It's at the confluence of three rivers. You know, there's two physical rivers and there's what's called a mystical river that meets at the same place once every 12 years. And it's very sacred to have a bathe in that spot. And it happens for 45 days. So over 45 days, 130 million people will congregate there.
Wow.
And I go to every single one of these gatherings. And at one gathering, I was there and I met this yogi. And he was meditating and he was very old. And I asked him, how long are you sitting and meditating? He says, I've been a yogi for 50 years, but he's been sitting in the exact same place meditating for 38 years. So I said, what do you do? And he says, I bath and I sit down. Sometimes I go and beg, or sometimes I get a little bit to eat, but whatever the first person gives me to eat, I survive on that. If nobody gives me anything, by a certain time, I don't. I just meditate. So I said, can you teach me how to meditate? And he asked me a question. He says, what's your favorite food? And I said, my favorite food is chocolate. So he says, have you ever tried to give it up? I said, I've tried to, but you know, I'm an ultra marathon runner, so I don't really think the need to give it up. I say, if I go for a run, my body burns it off. And he said, that's interesting. But he said, sometimes you give something up because it's good for the body. Sometimes you give something up because it's good for the mind. And he told me, you see, a piece of chocolate has to be lying on the table. Your eyes have to see it. Your hands have to pick it up and put it in your mouth. That's the only way you can eat it. He says, if you can't control something that you can see, what chance do you have of controlling something that you cannot see, which is your mind? So he says, the fastest way to strengthen the mind is to use what you can see to strengthen what you can't see. Okay. So he says, by giving up something that you can see, right, every day that you give it up is testament to how strong your mind is, right? And that was a beautiful piece. And I use this piece of information with every single one of my athletes. You know, I tell them, we decide on what is the one thing that we're going to give up. And we give it up together. And whenever we're hitting a really, really tough period in a game or in a competition or when they're faced with injury, I remind them of how mentally strong they are. Because I borrowed this from Jerry Springer's ideology, where he puts an X on the calendar every single day and he says, don't break the chain. Well, with all my athletes, we also have a chain going. And when we are deep in the dumps and your self-confidence and your self-worth is eroded, I show them the chain. And I said, this chain is so bloody long because you are so strong. Right. And if you're strong enough to make this chain this long, you're sure hell strong enough to get over whatever we've been faced with right now.
That is, you just gave two incredible lessons. I love that. I'm sitting here. I want to talk, but I'm just intaking everything. So I love that. Yeah, those are amazing. These are things that I'm sure our listeners are going to be able to intake and just learn from. I mean, yeah, that's amazing. I'm in awe right now. So thank you for that. That was pretty amazing.
Nice.
Long distance running. That's a big part of your life right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long you've been doing it, and do you compete? Do you do it personally? What's the daily routine for you training wise?
Yeah. I run on average between 60 to 80 K a week in training. I don't compete. I run for fun. I'll run a marathon in about 3 hours, 3:30, 3:45. That's the time. I love ultras and I love trail runs because I like to get out in nature, but it's really my form of meditation, to be honest. And what I like about it is the fact that, you know, when you mentally wire yourself, you can overcome anything. You know, when you're running an ultra marathon, like 100 kilometers, you're in pain from kilometer 30, 35. You're feeling pain, but you're able to push through, you know. And the reason why you're able to push through is because you know that at every single mark, you're going to be feeling this. You know, at 60Ks, I'm going to be getting blisters. You know, I'm going to be hungry. You know, I'm going to be thirsty. If you have a backpack, you know your traps are going to be tight and you're going to be having a headache. You know that you're going to be completely dehydrated, and you could, if you're running trails, you're going to get cut and it's going to bleed. And you're aware of all of this, and absolutely nothing stops you. Sometimes you get delirious, you're aware of that. Sometimes you throw up and you're aware of that. And I keep asking myself, I've said, the only reason I can get to that mark is two reasons. One is I've planned the entire journey and I know what to expect at every point. The second thing is I'm taking it one step at a time. So whenever I'm tired, I'm saying, telling myself, just take one more step. Because at mark zero, you can't be thinking of 100 kilometers. It's too far, you know? So that was an important lesson that I taught myself, was that, you know, so say I take it one step at a time, but I also have a bird's eye view on the entire journey, understanding that this is what I could be thrown. And when it does get thrown at me, I'm not caught off guard. I always have cognitive, viable, reliable options available at my disposal.
Now, with the ultra marathons, 100, how many times have you done that, completed that?
So I've run 100 mile. I've run 200 kilometers. I've done maybe 6 or 8 between 50 to 75 Ks.
That's incredible.
And I've run about close to 42K full marathons.
That is incredible. The 100. There's another gentleman on Instagram and that I actually followed and I've been trying to connect to get on our show. His name's Jesse. And he's done the Ultra 100 twice. And nice. And he has his video. It's a pretty inspiring video. At 43, 44, he had run the 100. And don't quote me exactly, but he's talking about he was at his last mile and his body was broken. He couldn't go anymore. And he had his brother or his brother-in-law on one arm and other, and they're guiding him. And as he was going, he was just at his limbs. He couldn't handle it. And a runner ran by him and looked at him and says, and just turned to him and said, "Finish like a champ," and just kept running. And he was like, in his head, he was so exhausted. He was mentally done. And he got upset with that. So that passed, he finished. But those words haunted him for the next 7 years. And at 50, I think it was at 50 or 51, he ended up running it again. And he actually brought in a trainer to mentally help him. And what he did was at every, the same thing, he took it mile by mile or kilometer by kilometer. And every mile, at a certain point, he would keep refreshing himself saying, "I feel great. I feel great." And he would just keep using these words. And he flew by. And he finished it like a champ. And 7 years later, and it's an incredible accomplishment, because the mental aspect of doing something like that, it takes so much preparation. And a lot of people don't have that will, that drive of preparation to be able to handle something like that. So it's such an amazing accomplishment. So congrats on that aspect, brother.
Yeah. You know, Jeff, you touched on something. I'll tell you this, and I always mention this to people.
Yeah.
I said, everyone looks at professional athletes, okay, and they watch us practice, and everyone thinks that the difference between amateurs and professionals is in the amount of practice. And I try to bring a little bit of clarity to this. You know, I say the difference between an amateur and a professional is that an amateur practices till he gets, and a professional practices till he can't get it wrong. That's the difference.
Okay. I love that.
An amateur will practice till he gets it right.
Yeah.
And a professional practice till he can't get it wrong. But, you know, I'll take this one level deeper. I'll say, you know, I used to work with the South African cricket teams, and I had an athlete by the name of Jonty Rhodes, who in an era of slow and healthy players was probably the fastest fielder we've ever had in the game. He's still an absolute legend. And we used to practice every day. A team practice was 4 hours. And then after that team practice, we used to take a single stump out in the cricket ground, the bag of balls, and he would throw it from various corners. I'd hit him balls and I'd catch, and he'd just practice his fielding. Now he's already the best in the world, and we're practicing every single day for an hour, hour and a half. And people used to come and ask us this, you know, why why are you doing this? You're already the best in the world and you're doing this. And I tell you, this is what people don't get about sport, is that athletes don't practice because it guarantees success. Absolutely nothing can guarantee success. The reason we practice is because there is no greater travesty on earth than getting an opportunity you are not prepared for. There is no greater travesty on earth than getting an opportunity you are not prepared for. Now, in my world of sport, an opportunity is 1/100th of a second. Before you know it, the ball's gone past you, the opportunities come, you didn't see the play, you didn't stop enough, you didn't cut it quickly enough. 1/100th of a second, it's gone. Okay, that's the opportunity you've been waiting for your whole life. And when that opportunity comes, you have to be ready to make sure you can take it and maximize it. And this is the difference between professional athletes and every single one. I always ask, I talk at corporates and ask corporates, I said, you know, in the world of corporates, I've heard tons of people bitching about opportunities. Everybody wants to get this position, wants this opportunity, wants this, want that. I said, if you want to really help yourself, do yourself this favor. Close your eyes right now and ask yourself, what is that one opportunity that you want? Okay. Now, if this very next second, that opportunity was given to you, are you mentally, physically, emotionally, spiritually ready to maximize that opportunity? And if the answer is no, then you better spend all your time praying that opportunity doesn't come. Because if it does come, you've messed it up. So this is what people need to realize, is that in the world of sport, we practice because we understand that, you know, nobody is guaranteed of an opportunity. You know, sport is a pure meritocracy, Jeff. The best will get there, the best will win. And nobody owes you an opportunity. You work hard, you get there. And when you get there, right, if that opportunity arises, you do all the work to make sure that you leverage it. You know, that's all it is.
Yeah, that's how's your mindset? When you talk about opportunity, you're talking about dedication and as an athlete, I love that little quote you said, they trained not to get it wrong kind of thing. So you're training to be the best of everything, right? So where's the difference? Not even difference. Where's your mindset with the drive? Would you consider that almost like the drive of somebody, their mental drive, that from the becoming the top of a sport to actually an amateur? Like you said, I do agree physically. It's you could take it to any sport. Like I was talking to an individual yesterday, and this is totally different, but it's Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, for example. He trains at a high level. And when you deal with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, there's a belt system. You go white belt, blue belt, brown, purple, black. Okay. I'm sorry, purple, brown, black. And we were talking about this from a purple belt to a black belt. At a purple belt, you know all the moves of a black belt. The difference from a black belt is they're always 3-4 moves ahead of you. It's that mental aspect. It's like a chess game. So with a pro athlete, how important like it is to be the individual to be so mentally strong to be able to focus like that, right? So a lot of it is the mental aspect, isn't it?
It's all mental.
Yeah.
And physiologically, if you look at the genetically, if I use the Olympic Games as an example, the 8 or 10 people who line up at the final of any event in Olympic Games is probably genetically closer to each other than two siblings are to each other, right? So physiologically, they're pretty similar. Genetically, they're pretty similar. The differentiator is really mentally, right? It's your ability to absorb pressure at that situation. It's your ability to have clarity of thought and perspective in that particular situation. Now, how do I break this down? This is actually where spirituality comes in. I was giving the example, and I'll give you a tennis example. On the 14th of July, 2019, Roger Federer played Novak Djokovic for the Wimbledon tennis final. And that Wimbledon final was special for 3 reasons. Okay, it was special because it was the longest Wimbledon final in the history of the competition. The second reason was that it was the first final that was decided by a match tiebreaker. And the third reason it was special was that it was the first time a male competitor came back from 2 match points down to win the championship. And that's never been done before. Now, what was even more special was in the post-match interview, Novak Djokovic made a comment. He said there was a moment in the game when the crowd were chanting Roger Federer's name And I had to remove myself from that environment. And that is actually the secret and the blueprint for life. You see, there's always two environments at play, Jeff. There's always an external environment that's providing some stimulus. And God willing, if it's in your favor, you'll get over the finish line. But there'll come a time when the environment is not supporting you anymore. And if you don't have a strong mind, it's the end of the road for you. The only person who can push forth, the only person who's got a chance of winning, is a person who's cultivated the second environment, which is your internal environment, which is your mind. Okay. Now, this is the tussle between the external and the internal. So you're right. There are tons of athletes playing. And when there's no pressure and the environment is right, anyone can win. It's a toss of a coin. But when the pressure is on, you can literally handpick the guy who's going to become a champion because you know what the quality of their mind is. What is their ability to absorb pressure? Who is the person that can remove himself from an external environment? And the reason why I'm saying this is spirituality, because there's a beautiful book in Vedic sciences called the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, which was written by the saint Patanjali. And he speaks of five states of mind. The Indian words that describe it is state one is sipta, state two is mudda, state three is vikshipta, state three is ekagra, and state four is akagra, state five is niruddha. And I'll explain it to you. The first three states of mind, a person is directly impacted by their environment. Right? So if I change the environment, then I'll change who they are. If I put them in an environment of highly motivated people, they'll start working like that. If I put them in a toxic environment, they'll be like that. You know, they'll keep getting engulfed by their environment. State four, the person can rise above their environment. Right, which means that you can put them in a toxic environment, but they can hold their state of mind. They're not engulfed by it. They don't feel the pressure of it. They can maintain that certain state above the environment. And state five, they influence their environment. You know, so for example, the best example I could give that people would understand is the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama, for example, is an example of someone who's in state of mind. You see, if we were all sitting in the room having a drink, right? Some people would come into that room and they would start drinking because we all are, right? Some people would come into the room and they'd sit in the room, but they can hold their ability to not drink. And then there's a person who would walk into the room who would stop all of us from drinking. You understand? They change the environment. You see, state five is you're so powerful and so mentally in control of yourself, your environment molds to you. Okay, now the secret is to know what mental state you're in. Because when you understand what mental state you're in, you understand the impact your external environment has on you whilst you're cultivating your internal environment. Cultivating the internal environment is a journey that has to go on every single day. But understanding the impact your external environment is having on you is really the secret to success. Because then you can draw your awareness to those factors and then start modifying and manipulating it so that you don't get distracted. And this is really a secret that not too many people are aware of.
This has been such an amazing podcast. I love everything you're doing. And you're impacting your environment. And you could go to a 12-year-old kid in school. How does he act? His environment, his peers. That goes from every level, right? So you could go from a business level and an entrepreneurial level. Like, it's that old saying, you surround yourself around people you want to be.
Yeah.
And the most successful people are never fearful of surrounding themselves around individuals that are better than them, they're higher than places you want to be. And I always tell entrepreneurs, doesn't matter what level you are, hang around people that you achieve to be. Always. That's the simplest rule if you want to better yourself on a daily basis, right? Oh, I love that. I love that part. Yeah. And I love that whole description of the Dalai Lama walking in, because as you're going through that conversation, I don't drink and I'm always around social circles that people drink, and I'm usually the only one that never drinks in there. So when you were talking about that, I was putting myself in that situation. Then when you brought in the other situation where there's individuals that could change the environment, they mold the environment. It makes you want to be that. It makes you, your mind starts thinking about that. As soon as you're saying that, I'm like, okay, how could I do that? How could I get into that state of mind? I love that aspect, because it's something that a lot of people don't think about. A lot of people, like you said, they'll mold themselves into a situation because they want to feel part of something, which is the worst way to live. And that's society, right? And that's social media, because social media, we're painting this picture of our, especially Instagram, our best moments, our best images. So you're trying to always paint this picture, and then you deal with, this is pure off topic, you deal with a younger generation where they're impacted by all these beautiful people, these beautiful images, and they want to be these things that really mind and body you shouldn't. You should be focused on building the best you could be, right? So your environment is such a huge impact of who you are. So yeah, and surround yourself, and I mean, in the end of the day, learn and try to master being able to control your environment. I love that. That's a great example you brought there with the Dalai Lama. I love that aspect.
Yeah,
you've been full of lessons today, buddy. Like I'm like in my head, I'm honestly, as you're talking,
yeah,
I'm like, okay, when I've told myself two or three times, when this is all done, I want to replay this. I want to hear this again. So this has been so many little lessons in here. And I do an episode on Wednesdays. I do a full episode on Mondays, and I do an episode on Wednesdays. Everything's pre-recorded. And Wednesdays is, we call it 6-minute hump day, and it's more of just lessons and lessons. And I'm like, I could cut out so many clips from here, from our podcast, and have so many lessons for the next like 6 months. So I love everything you're doing. I mean, you're very knowledgeable. You're very impactful the way you talk, because you break it down in a direction that people could understand. There's a lot of people that teach lessons, or they're trying to impact somebody by showing them something, but they put it at a level where you can't see yourself understanding. But you break down in a metaphorical story that it makes you understand the situation, which is a storytelling. In a way, which is a very, very hard art to master, and you've mastered it. So congrats on that aspect. I love that part of you as well. So you're doing amazing stuff, brother. So
thank you.
Where do you see yourself in the next 5 years? So, like, is there a goal in your mind of how many people you want to impact, how many children? Like, where do you see yourself in the next 5 years?
That's a tough one. You know, right now I'm trying to build my authorship, and I'm trying to build my speaking, to be honest. I'm trying to, I'm based in India, but I'm trying to grow my audience in the US and Europe a little bit. I'll start launching probably some of my own shows. On a physiological lens, I'm doing a little bit of work on gut bacterial research. Okay. And gut bacteria and autoimmune disorders. So that's what's happening. So the different lenses. On a career point, I want to really expand my speaking base in the US, because I just feel like, you know, I could make an impact in people who think a little bit like me, and I'm just looking for interesting ways to open some opportunities. I'm sitting in Asia, and I feel a little isolated from everything that's happening in the personal growth, personal mastery space. So I'm tapping into a few things. From an authorship point of view, I'm looking at something really interesting, which is I'm looking and studying the age of our subconscious. Does your subconscious mind age like your conscious mind? You see, we understand that Parkinson's and Alzheimer's are diseases of the conscious mind, but is there a disease of the subconscious mind? You know, what happens? Does it degenerate? Does it not generate? Does it constantly regenerate? What is the biology or the neurobiology of the subconscious mind in some shape and form? And then I'm superimposing that on understanding that, you see, because I do, as a psychologist, I work on the psychic root of diseases. Okay. So I understand that a certain thought process will manifest in the illness in a certain part of your body. And this research exists there. It doesn't belong to me, but you know, in peeling away the layers, I've understood, like, for example, territorial anger is situated in the colon and situated in the stomach. You know, boundary conflict for females could be in the uterus, could be in the liver. You know, we understand how if there's a conflict and you're ruminating on a specific pain or trauma consistently, psychologically, it'll manifest in this way. But I've also understood through spirituality that we are multiple bodies. You have a physical body, then you have what's called a vital body, then you have a mental body, and then you have your superconscious or your spiritual body that's on the top. And when you get a disease on your physical body, it's already transcended all four bodies. Okay. So what I'm trying to work on is that my next book's going to be teaching people how to manifest, not manifest, how to notice the subtle differences in each of these bodies, so that we can really nip illness in the bud before it manifests in the physical body. Right? So that's what I'm trying to peel away from that point of view. And
how let me dive into that. I mean, that's, we're talking about at a such a high level of conscience, right? Like, and as we're talking, you're breaking it down. Once again, you make it very visual, which is NLP, like the vaccine. Everything you do is very visual, which is, makes it very understandable to most people. Do you think the average, or even just humans in general, will be able to have that higher understanding of their body to see, for example, disease happening from that outer spiritual level, like having that, like where do you see the evolution of us to understanding something like that? Because that's very complicated, right?
It's super complicated. And the reason why most people don't understand it is because the like gratitude, for example, doesn't have an intrinsic quantifiable measurable on a day-to-day basis. So the memory is not extrapolating that over a prolonged period of time. So, yeah. So it's changing your entire thought process. It's in changing your entire neurobiology. We know on a spiritual level, the energy you put out is the energy you attract. We understand all of this, but because we're not quantifying it and you can't see the measurable impact of it on a day-to-day basis, we tend to lose track of it. Okay. Now, losing that track of it is also a byproduct of social media, because we're so used to seeing things happen instantaneously. We're so used to scrolling down once and a new red light pops up, or a new image pops up, or you close the app and you open it up and there's a new notification. So we're used to things instantaneously, where when things are happening a little slower in the psychological body, in the vital body and spiritual body, that we're not taking notice of it, but we're taking notice of what's happening in the physical body. Now, what I'm going to have to try to do and try to figure out is, how do I bring what may not necessarily be a subtle, noticeable feel change in your body? How do I bring it into your awareness? You see, the secret is to bring something back into our awareness. I call it the infinite loop. You know, things are already happening in your subconscious mind. It's because it's not in your conscious mind that you're not thinking about it. Right. Now, if I can somehow bring that into your conscious mind, okay, you'll start becoming more aware of it.
Give me an example. Yeah.
Like, probably one of the best examples I can give you is, I'll give you an example of a patient of mine. Okay. So a patient of mine came and he had psoriasis over his entire body, and it'd been prolonging for 2 years. So I said, what have you tried? And it's an illness now on a physical body. So he's tried, he says, you know, I've tried doing cleansers, gut cleansers, I've used creams, I've used ointments, I've done everything. So I said, okay. So I said, give me a few days, I'll get back to you. And I kind of left it. And then he phoned me back. He says, you haven't got back to me. The reason I actually hadn't got back to him was because what I was going to tell him, I wasn't sure whether he was going to read. He wanted to hear it. Now, what I wanted to tell him was that, you see, psoriasis, or disease on the skin, is the psychic root of it is called a healing illness conflict. Okay. A healing illness conflict means what? Means that something that should be bringing you love, right, is actually the source of your pain. So something that should be causing you love, or should be, you would have thought in every shape and form would be bringing you love, or bringing you happiness or joy, is actually causing you a lot of pain. That is why you're developing a skin disorder. So how do I present this to this guy? So I eventually, he persisted, and I asked him, I said, okay, you know, I need to ask you a question, and it's going to seem really personal. Okay. But have you had any traumatic incident in the 6 months prior to when your psoriasis started? And the trauma has to be linked to someone you really love. Okay. So someone you really love either passed away, or got really sick, or perhaps stole some money from you, or your business got taken away from you. Something that should have brought you a lot of joy was suddenly ripped out of you, and you haven't come to terms with it. And I said, this would have happened between 6 to 8 months before you first developed psoriasis. And then he started crying. And he says that, you're right. He says, 6 months before that, I had a 10-year-old son. My son had a cough. He went into the hospital for an infection. They kept him in the hospital. He picked up an infection, and within 5 days, he had passed away. Okay. And he says, I've never been able to come to terms with that. So I said, that is the trauma that is ruminating in your mind, that's manifested as an illness on your skin. Right. Now, for us to correct the skin, we need to put the switch off. We need to get you to come to terms with that emotional pain. We need to teach you to move behind that. Now, so we're looking at two things. We're looking at the psychic trauma, the psychological trauma of thinking about this pain, about the loss of your son, about all of that. You're looking at the physical illnesses. And then you're looking at how ruminating on that thought has completely suppressed your entire energy. You know, your entire energy, you know more, you will not feel comfortable in, and how has it suppressed your energy? When you're in that mental state, you've lost perhaps faith. You don't perhaps meditate, you don't pray, you don't feel the need to connect with people. If someone is high, you're pulling yourself away. So you see how every single body is impacted. And the thing is that for us to change everything, we need to change everything. I need to change. I can put a cream on his body or I can cleanse his gut from the inside, but I have to change the psychic root of it. And then I have to also infuse him in an environment where he's surrounded by people who are operating at a higher vibrational energy. We have to tap it at every single level for this to be a transformational healing, for this to be what's instantaneous healing in some shape and form. Now, nobody understands this. And the reason why nobody understands this is not because there's not enough research to validate it, Jeff. It's because we have to understand that the agenda around big pharma, the agenda around big corporations to position a certain narrative to us is so strong that some other narratives just don't get the time of day that it needs. Okay. And it doesn't mean that it's not true. And I'm not an advocate saying only go for alternate therapy. In fact, I'm a massive advocate that two opposing truths can coexist. Alternate medicine and Western medicine can be beautifully merged together to help a person discover themselves and heal. But the problem is that a very small percentage of ours are interested in marrying these two. The majority of the people are only interested in positioning one lens to you. And I'll tell you something beautifully interesting around, and this is why in spirituality, in Vedic ancient wisdom, they say disease can only enter the body through two ways. It can enter through your mouth, which is by the food you eat, or it can enter through your brain by the way you think. It only says that there are only two ways that disease can enter the body. Okay. And this is really, really fascinating for us to understand that if disease can only enter in these two ways, these are really the two that we need to control. And it also speaks about nourishing the body using five elements. Okay. So you can bring your body into balance with earth, fire, water, air, and space.
So
it says that these are the five elements that you need to consume every single day to bring your body's prakriti, which is energy, into balance. So and it says very interesting, it says, like, for example, water. You don't just drink your water, but you eat your water. And what does eating your water mean? It means eating water rich foods. So foods that give a lot of water out or hold a lot of water, eat them. So fruits, vegetables, melons, spinach, green leaves, eat your water. Then sun, you can sun gaze, you can sunbathe, and you can eat sun-ripened food. Okay. Air is your breath work, right? Balancing your energy through your breath work. Earth is eating plant-based foods, and space is fasting. Incidentally, fasting is the only thing that is common in every single religion on the planet, on all continents. It's the only thing that is common in every single religious practice in the world. Every single religious practice promotes fasting. Right?
I have a smile on my face because a lot of the things you're saying is stuff that I try to impact in my daily life. Like my last meal every day is between 8 and 8:30, and I fast the next day till 12:30, 1 o'clock. I try to get at least 16 hours of fasting. I've been doing that for a few years now. It's impacted me more of a physical aspect. I feel like my body has more time to heal. I feel better. I feel more energetic. Another thing, too, is I've implied probably about 6 months ago. There's different ways. Everybody calls it different. People call it prayer. Some people call it meditation. I call it just breathing. Every single morning, I'm up at 4:30 every morning. I've been doing this for years and years and years and years. And I'm up at 4:30 and I have a very strict routine every morning where I do a little physical activity. I let the dog out. I take my vitamins. And I've incorporated about 6 months ago, I call it breathing. It takes me 5-10 minutes. And I just sit down. Everybody's still sleeping in my household. And sometimes I'll sit on the couch. Sometimes I'll sit on the floor. And I just breathe. And I think of my day past. So I don't clear my mind. I use it as a reflection moment of what I want to achieve today and what I thought about yesterday. And I just breathe, just relax. And then it's almost like a reset for my day. And I actually, and I did a little video on this. I started in about 8-12 weeks ago. Every single morning also is I look in the mirror and I tell myself I'm going to have a wonderful day 5 times. And I've incorporated that. So I do a lot of these things where, and I see the impact. I see the impact of just how more relaxed I am, how much more energy I have, how much more I have to give back. Because I do have long days. I'm go. Yeah. But I have a very, how I keep track of my day or how I keep this is I'm very schedule oriented and I need to live on a very schedule because I'm everywhere. But from 3 to 7 o'clock is family time. I've never missed, and I could honestly tell you since my kids were born, I have never missed a dinner with them. I'm home every single night for dinner. And I could honestly tell you every single moment of my children's life, whether it's a recital, a baseball game, a graduation, I have never missed it. And I prioritize their schedules into my schedule, and then I work my schedule around their schedule. So I find that family time is so important. That bees dinner. I always like having dinner with the family because that's our time to talk and communicate. And I think that's a lost art from a lot of families is they're always on the go, they're always on the run, and they don't sit down and understand their children and their families. So all of a sudden, their children are 16, 17, and they've lost that connection with their children. So I find it's very important in their upbringing to have that connection with them. So I love everything you're saying because there's so many aspects of it that I on a smaller level, I try to impact in my life as well, right? So that's fantastic. So I'm also a strong believer in your mind, your mental, it controls a lot of the poison in your body. I wouldn't even call it poison, but it's, and I'll give you an example is I've had two individuals in my lifetime, both pass away, close friends pass away with cancer. One of them, the minute he was diagnosed, he lasted 6 months. And out of the 6 months, probably the last three, it was such a suffering moment because he gave up the minute he heard he had they had that letter C attached to his name. Mentally, it was just done at that point. And then another individual that's just a very optimistic, very, very just live for the moment and took that as I have to live every day to the fullest. And he ended up living another 7-8 years of just a wonderful life. And so I believe that, I mean, at that point, your body is already, you said it's already impacted you past those 4 or 5 levels, but mentally it just showed when you look at both cases, they had very similar situations, how mentally being a mentally strong individual, that's very positive, very living in the moment could make a huge impact in how your body reacts to everything. Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, every situation is a byproduct of one's perspective. And really, that's where mindfulness is so important. That's where meditation is so important. And that's where that circle of people you surround yourself with is so important. I'm a massive believer that how we react to a situation is actually a byproduct of the 5 people closest to us. Okay. If you have 5 people who are very grounded and teaching you to look at things from multiple perspectives, you'll approach a situation with more calm, composure, with more openness. If you are surrounded by people who are constantly overreacting, people who are aggressive, people who are vengeful and rageful, you're going to approach a situation with tunnel vision. You're always going to approach it from a victim mentality. So, that's why it's so important to be very mindful of who you're spending your time and who you're really talking to, where you're giving your energy from, because they're impacting you way more than you actually realize. They're impacting literally every single decision, whether it's with your kids, whether it's with your family, whether it's your organization, every single thing is being impacted by that. And, you're saying something, Jeff, I have the deepest amount of admiration for how you live your life in terms of your organization and spending time with your kids.
I look at it as you live in the present moment. And I always say this, my parents are still alive, knock on wood, and they're healthy and they're wonderful. They live 30-minute drive for me. And I'm 43 years old. And every single morning, I still call my mom and have a conversation. Before I go to bed, I have a conversation with my mom every night. I'll drive down to Toronto as much as I can just to have a coffee with my dad. And people are like, oh, because I absolutely drives me crazy when I see a friend or I see a post on social media and be like, oh, my father passed away. I wish I had more time with him. And then I know that person never would see their parents every 6 months or for a holiday on Thanksgiving or Christmas. And I'm like, you had the opportunity. Yeah. Live in the presence. People don't live in the presence. People are Mr. World. Like everybody's looking at that. I want to have that nice car. I want to have that nice house. I want to have this. And they're so focused on these and they don't live in the moment. And life changes in seconds. You say you're one phone call away from your life changing, very impact. And I always tell everybody, you have to live in the moment. Live for today. Don't worry about tomorrow. It's funny because my wife and I are very different. My wife, we've been married for 17 years. We just had our anniversary September 20. And she's very laid back. She's very 9 to 5, finishes work. She wants to come home. She's very independent. And I appreciate that because we have that nice balance because I'm go, 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 build, 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 impact as many people as I can. She's just 9 to 5. And she has a saying she says to me all the time and it's very simple. She goes, if today didn't change, today was a good day. She loves that simplicity of just living in the moment. She just wants to build memories with her children. And that's one thing, like I talk about memories with her children is one of my purposes. I find that everybody can have many purposes, right? And one of my purposes I'm pushing towards is I want to help entrepreneurs have a balance between fatherhood and business. And that's one of my goals. And that's one of the things I'm moving towards as we speak right now is I find a lot of entrepreneurs, they don't have that balance. And that's something I think I've somewhat mastered because I find that balance in both and I'm succeeding in both in a positive way at the moment, right? So it's very easy to not live in the moment and think of the future and think of what's going to happen later on. And then all of a sudden something happens and that moment is gone. So advice, and this is obviously you're the guest here, but I'm giving you advice as well, trying to right now, is just live in the moment. It's spend as much time with your loved ones and your family and your close friends as possible because you don't know what happens tomorrow, right?
You know, Jeff, listening to you and I think, you know, we've peeled away in this conversation, we've peeled away so much of each other's lives that I can tell you something. You know, I just wrote a book on balance and I was saying, you know, the one mistake I realize that people make is that they confuse balance with symmetry. Okay. You know, when you ask them balance, they think balance is equal and opposite. Things need to be perfectly symmetrical. If you ask them an image of balance, they think of a weighing scale or a seesaw or something like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, in doing research, I peeled away the layers of balance in cosmology, neurobiology, astrology, physiology, biology, all of this. And I realized a few things. I realized that balance in its natural form is asymmetrical and not symmetrical. Okay. You know, if you look at the best example, you look at the golden ratio, which is how plants open, how nature evolves, how everything opens up in some shape and form. It operates in accordance to what's called the golden ratio. No part of the golden ratio is symmetrical. It's purely asymmetrical, but it's a perfect representation of balance. The second thing is balance is fluid and dynamic, like you said, you know, and you got to approach it as dynamic and fluid. The one thing we confuse is it with static. We think balance needs to be static. We think it's a destination we're going to arrive and then we're going to be okay. The balance that you have today may not be the perfect balance for tomorrow, and you need to understand and approach that. And the third thing I realized, and this is very important, was that I realized that the most important aspect of balance is actually the fulcrum, the middle point on which something is balancing, right? Yeah. You see, and how I said, if I give you a square cube, a block of cube, and ask you to balance something on top, anyone can do that. If I give you a nail and you stick it into the ground and ask you to balance something, with a little bit more difficulty, you probably get it right. If I give you a small water balloon, okay, and I ask you to balance something, it becomes extremely difficult. And the only thing that's changed in these three examples is the integrity of the fulcrum, the central point. And in your life, in anyone's life, people have to realize that you are the fulcrum. And your integrity is directly linked to you answering the question, who am I? So I asked people this question. I said, if you had to answer the question, who am I, without telling me your name or your surname, your age, your sex, your gender, which city you live in, what work you do, how much money you have in the bank, who your wife is, what title you have in your company, without telling me any of this, can you even answer this question of who am I? I said, if you can peel away those layers with answering this without the titles that the world has given you, right? That is defining your integrity. And if your integrity is intact, your probability is super high. And what I realized in our conversation with you is that my balance model has four verticals. It has body, mind, relationships, and environment. Okay. And body is your vehicle. So if your vehicle is strong, you've given yourself more time to achieve your goals. Your mind is the strength of your mind. The stronger your mind is, the more you're able to remove distractions from your sight and stay focused. Okay. Your relationships are the five people around you. You are a byproduct of them. Your environment is where you work, where you sleep, where you play. Right? That's your environment. Your environment is directly impacting you, like I spoke about Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. And what I realized about balance is that every single person on earth is aspirational. Like entrepreneurs want to achieve success, different peoples want to achieve it. Some want to run a marathon. They want to push their body out. Some people want to push their work so their environment vertical is going out. Some people want to get married and fall in love, and they want to push the dynamics of that relationship out. The secret is to know where you're anchored, right? You see, if you want to get out of your comfort zone, growth only happens in outside of comfort zone. And balance is a representation of your midpoint. Now, I give people the example. I said, if something is out of your reach and you want to get it, there are only two ways to get it. One is to jump and leap and hope that you grab it. That's your leap of faith. And most likely, yeah, 9 out of 10 times, you won't grab it. Okay. The second way is you have a rope or you have a string or you have a friend of someone holding you. And then you inch your way a little bit closer to it. And then you grab it when you get closer, right? The second is representation of what is called that anchoring stable point, being stably anchored in one so you can push yourself out the other way. And the reason why I'm mentioning and going through the trouble of saying all this is because I realized that everything that you've achieved in your life, my friend, in terms of your business, in terms of doing everything, right? What is very clear to me is that your relationship vertical with your kids, with your parents, with your wife, is your strongest anchoring point. And as long as that is anchored into the ground, you'll be able to push yourself out of your comfort zone in whichever shape and form you want to, whether it's running a marathon, whether it's strengthening the mind, whether it's opening another 10 businesses and helping it grow, whether it's making more podcasts. Because why? You're anchored in one space. And people don't know who they are. And they don't know where their anchor is. And without these two points answered, you're going to be like a leaf in a pinna. So if there's anything anyone would invest in, I would invest in asking them to define who you are. Because only when you know who you are you giving yourself enough of a chance to bring your life actually into balance.
I love that. I love that. I'm gonna throw that on you now. Who are you?
Who am I? You know, I'm defined by a few things. You know, I have a saying which I live by. One is, be as humble as a blade of grass and be more tolerant than a tree. Okay. So humble as a blade of grass means I don't look down on anyone, right? I force myself to not look down. A blade of grass is really, really low. So you're always looking up at people. You're not looking down on anyone. Right. So that's one. The second is, be more tolerant than a tree. Understand that a tree will stand there through every single variable. It's hot, it's raining, there's a storm, there's a cyclone, it's standing there, right? That's its job. So be humble, stand true to what you believe in, right? No matter what you get thrown at, stand true to what you believe in. And the last one is, always see yourself in the mode of service. Understand, be grateful for the person who comes to you in the hour of need, because even that is a blessing. You know, you can have all the money in the world, okay, but you cannot help someone if someone doesn't need it. You understand? Yeah, yeah. So the person who is in need is as big a blessing as the wealth that you have. And you have to see it like that. So who am I? I am someone who's aspiring to be humble. I see myself as a servant of the God. Someone who's humble and someone who's aspiring to be as tolerant as a tree.
I love that. This is, we've been here for an hour and a half. We could probably go on for hours here. This is amazing. We're going to end it on that note. This is amazing. I'm honored to have the opportunity to have met you, and I'm hoping this will be a more of a long-term friendship, because you're so powerful. Everything you say is just so powerful. And I am very on the understanding that you coming into the North American market, and we're the Canadian market, but you coming to North American market is needed. Your voice is needed, because you're going to impact millions and millions of people. So don't stop your journey no matter what, because there's a higher purpose for what you're doing, and you're going to impact so many people. And I do believe you have to get yourself in front of as many people as you possibly can, because I've had some wonderful entrepreneurs. I've had some wonderful individuals that have impacted a lot of people, but you have a higher purpose. There's just everything about you, everything about you is positive. I love everything about you, and just keep moving. I always say at the end of my podcast, that's one thing I always say, is keep moving forward. Keep moving forward, because I do want to see where your journey goes. I do, like, I have a purpose where I want to impact a lot of people, but I do want to see, honestly, and I honestly, truthfully am saying this to you from the bottom of my heart, I want to see your journey in the next 3 years, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, because I do believe you're going to just explode in the way of impacting so many people. And in your word and your lessons, everything you've done in the last half an hour, hour and a half, these lessons, every time you teach somebody, like I said, you're just empowering more and more and more and more people to impact more and more people. It's just that domino effect. And keep doing what you're doing, brother. You're going to do wonderful things in this world. And if you see the wall behind me, I got some very impactful people. You're on your journey to get there. So just keep doing what you're doing. Thank you so much for this, man. This has been amazing. Any last things you want to say to our audience?
No, I think we've peeled away the layers of this opportunity. And I think the only thing is, the greatest amount of inertia in anything is in the beginning, isn't it? And once we overcome that inertia, things will start moving forward. Each person's inertia is a little bit different from each other. So don't lose faith. And I think the one thing I like to remind people is that, we're here for a far larger purpose.
Yeah, 100%. So,
and see it like that. See the person who needs help as a blessing in your life. And I tell people, like, if I have to give people one exercise, I tell them every time it takes you 1 second, just say God, whichever God you pray, or universe, or whatever you're praying to, just say, give them a reason to smile today.
I'm gonna give you one little thing that I do on a regular basis. It's been harder lately because everybody's forced to wear a mask. The impact of a smile, how powerful a smile. And I teach this to my kids. There's certain lessons to my kids I always done. I've done since they're little, is three things. Is I always teach them. I believe fear is something that's manifest and taught. No child is taught with fear. So on a regular basis, I find things that they're scared to do, and I force them to do it. And it's teaching that mind to get stronger. That's one. Second is giving back. We do a lot of charity stuff. We do a lot of food fundraisers. And I want them to be impacted in doing that as well. Whether, even as a small kid, we're going to the mall, and I'll see somebody walking, and I'll say, hey, Tiago, go hold the door for that lady. Like, I'll do stuff like that because I want it to become part of their material, but I wanted to be part of who they are growing up. So it's just teaching them how to do the little things that are impacting people. And I always say to them is, and this is part of the second part, is I always say smile. And I, there's nothing more rewarding. You're just walking down the street or walking in the mall, and somebody's walking by you, and you had their heads down, they look up, and you give them a smile. And 9 out of 10 times, that person will just, they almost freeze, and then they'll smile back. And it's like, you see this joy in them, like, oh, and it's just that impact of a smile does a world of difference. And if everybody were to do that on a regular basis, I think we'd be a lot more happier of a society. And last thing I do with my kids is work ethic. I even through the summer, I have in the office working. I have my 12 and 14-year-old working. And I believe teaching them work ethic is so, so important as a parent, because entrepreneurs, they seem to, for their kids, they've done well, and they always have that mindset is, I don't want my children to go through what I went through. I don't want my children. No, it's not like that, man. It's teaching them work ethic, because they can still be successful, but they have to know they have to work to earn it.
Exactly.
And a lot of kids nowadays, they don't. And then that's why they feel like they feel entitled. And we live in the world of entitlement. I have many employees I hire, they're in their 20s and 25s. And after a week, 2 weeks here, they're giving me attitude. And I'm like, and it's that entitlement. They've been babied by their parents, given anything, everything they singly want. And they have that, they live in this world of entitlement where they feel like everybody owes them. And I don't, and that was one thing I told my wife, I don't want my children ever to have that mindset that they have to have that mindset they need to earn and work towards what they want. Because there will be a moment I'm not there, who's going to teach them that lesson, right? So that's, I'm leaving on that note as well. So I'm always jumping into your story. So I apologize about that.
No, it's great. It's a conversation. It's not an interview. So don't worry. Yeah,
I love it. Thank you so much. I'm going to put on all our show notes. How to get a hold of you, how to be inspired by you, how to purchase your books. I mean, this has been such an honor and thank you very much. Thank you for coming on. Great pleasure. And like I said, I'm so looking forward to seeing everything you're going to be doing in the near future. Thank you so much, brother.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. This was a real honor. Thank you so much.
That's a wrap for today. I want to thank Shamal for taking a time out of his busy schedule. What an honor to have him on. Super excited to see his future and where it goes in the growth. I extremely enjoy this podcast. Tons of lessons. I hope everyone enjoyed it as well. If you guys enjoyed it as much as I did, please tell your family, tell your friends, tell everyone, spread the word. We're trying to build something special here. Leave a review. 5 stars would be absolutely amazing. Until next week, everyone, always move forward.